In the matter of the civil commitment of PD, can we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Ms. Raymond Silver, please.
May it please the court. My client, PD, faces indefinite and possibly lifelong confinement in a former state prison staffed by correction officers. He is convinced that his commitment was a terrible mistake that could ruin the rest of his life. If ever there was a case where access to full discovery is essential to ensure that a person is not wrongfully locked away, this is the case. But the state argues that PD has less discovery rights than a party in a fender bender case. It is inconceivable that a personal injury litigant has greater discovery rights than someone confronting lifetime civil confinement in a secure facility behind razor wire. The state position must be rejected because this court has never interpreted discovery rules in a way that would strip away a person's ability to protect their liberty and due process rights. As lawyers, we know that discovery is necessary to give us information to expose the pitfalls and shortcomings of any state action. Given the high stakes involved in a civil commitment, why wouldn't we want full discovery so we can get the commitment decision right? Yet, the trial court held that PD has no discovery right and should just make do with the records that the state voluntarily gave to him. But that limited material is not sufficient for PD to be able to successfully challenge his commitment. He needs the requested discovery to prove that the state used an inaccurate and unreliable method when it predicted his recidivism risk. My adversary dismisses as frenetic PD's efforts to get relevant discovery. The state says PD ignores the reality that those who face SVPA commitment have never had full access to the discovery they seek. PD is now before this court so that this court can change this one-sided reality that only works for the state but ties the hands of those who seek to challenge their SVPA commitment. PD's fundamental liberty interests are at stake. This court recognized in In Re Civil Commitment of DY that SVPA commitment does implicate a compelling liberty interest. It is time that this court recognize a right to discovery so SVPA litigants can protect that vital liberty interest. The trial court's decision also violates PD's due process rights. Both the United States Supreme Court and this court have held that SVPA commitment laws must be interpreted so they comply with due process rights. The trial court's denial of discovery not only violated PD's right to due process, but it also failed to identify any legal authority that would justify such a draconian restriction of discovery. The 14th Amendment says no state shall deprive a person of liberty without due process of law. Article 1, Paragraph 1 of the New Jersey Constitution also protects due process values. This court held in Doe v. Porritt that whenever the state chooses to take an action that can implicate a constitutional right, that triggers the need for due process protections to protect those constitutional rights at issue. Similarly, in Jamkojian v. New Jersey State Parole Board, this court held that the state cannot impose a curfew on a convicted sex offender as a new parole condition unless they have procedural safeguards in place so that that person can meaningfully challenge their potential loss of liberty. In Jamkojian, the state also said it was an administrative burden to give those procedural protections, but the court rejected that claim in favor of a protection of constitutional liberty rights. Now, PD faces an even greater liberty loss than the defendant in Jamkojian, who only faced a home curfew. In this case, PD faces a total loss of liberty in a former prison with barbed wire, lock gates, and guards. He needs full discovery rights so he can meaningfully challenge his commitment. The United States Supreme Court has long held that discovery is a necessary due process protection to safeguard liberty interests. In Brady versus Maryland, the court held that given the liberty interest at stake, the state cannot violate a person's discovery rights by denying discovery that could be exculpatory or could help a defendant to challenge the state's case. Several federal courts have applied the Brady rule in the SVPA context because SVPA commitment also implicates constitutional liberty interests. The trial court's due process violation becomes even more apparent when this court considers the fact that courts across the country have granted broad discovery rights to SVPA litigants. 20 states, the District of Columbia, and the federal government all have sex offender commitment laws. Not a single jurisdiction besides the trial court of New Jersey has ever denied SVPA litigants the right to discovery. Surprisingly, the state questions whether PD even risks a lifelong loss of liberty. The state claims that because some residents have been discharged from the special treatment unit over time, that PD cannot say that he faces possibly lifelong confinement. But it is a fact that once PD is committed, he may never be released. It's also significant to note that the state is making its argument by citing discharge statistics that are outside the record. It is not only ironic, but it is improper and fundamentally unfair that the state denied PD discharge statistics that he asked for in his discovery and then cites similar discharge statistics in its brief. The state is even incomplete in the numbers that it cites. It fails to give this court any information about all of those SVPA residents who left the special treatment unit because they died or were transferred to a nursing home. But this court should not be relying on information outside the record at all.
How is that relevant to your defense? How is whether other people left, died, what the analysis was in those cases? How is that relevant?
It is
to
only
your case?
Relevant to show the significant liberty interest at stake, and I'm asking this court to disregard that information. It is cited in the state's brief. I'm saying it is improper.
But you're asking for it. Okay.
The reason we ask for it in our discovery is we're trying to get information.
Let me take it to number 7.
Yes.
Identify all residents with initials replacing names. Fine. Have been released from the STU since its inception in 1999 to the community state. And then you have A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. Now, I recognize discovery is somewhat of a fishing expedition, but the ocean you seek is pretty deep here.
It is relevant to show the error rates in terms of this. We are trying to challenge the very risk assessment methodology that the state is using. And one of the relevant factors to consider is what has the past error rate been when the state has predicted that someone won't.
How would that be admissible if just on your argument?
Where
is the scientific basis for this?
For example, if the state expert who's appearing in PD's case also had made decisions that people should not have been released because he determined that those people had a high risk of reoffense, but over his objection, those individuals were released and they were fine in the community for a decade or more, that might be relevant to show that this particular expert is not able to reliably assess a person's recidivism risk. But, Your Honor,
do you have an expert that would say that, or is that just your argument? The fact that an expert may have been wrong in other cases, how does that affect the expert's opinion in this particular case?
We do have experts who can look at to see whether a particular risk assessment methodology has been proven to be reliable.
All you need
that
is a methodology then. You don't need the names of the individuals.
We don't need the names of the individuals.
Well, that's what you're seeking here. You're seeking individual
only
information.
Only my initials so we can sort out to make sure we're not double counting individuals, for example. But, Your Honor, the trial court in this case specifically stated he was not ruling on the relevancy of individual interrogatories. Instead, he made a categorical decision that Court Rule 410.1 did not apply, even though he rejected the state's argument that this other court rule, 474.7, applied. He said, no, that doesn't either, but
okay,
he still...
Okay, let's stop there. So 474.7 is involuntary civil commitment. There is a discovery provision. Would you be satisfied with that?
No, Your Honor.
You don't like that?
No, we don't like that. Well, it depends on how this court interprets that rule. No. First of all,
you have a question for me.
Please tell us what's wrong with that rule, why that rule wouldn't logically extend here in your judgment.
Okay. There's a number of reasons why it should not apply. First, when you look at the language of 474.7, it says nothing about the SVPA. And we believe the trial court correctly ruled that R-474-7 only applies to involuntary psychiatric...
No, so we understand that it doesn't apply. The question that you're hearing is, would it logically apply? What would not be adequate if the court were to extend this rule to cover this case?
It depends on how this court interprets that rule. My interpretation of that rule is it says nothing that restricts discovery to just the documents listed. When you look at why that rule was drafted, the comments say it was drafted in part to codify the holding in Bush v. Callan, which expanded the rights of patients in psychiatric hospitals. Even though there was a rule governing psychiatric hospitals that said medical records are confidential, in that case, Bush v. Callan, it said, no, a person facing psychiatric commitment still has a right to his own medical records. So that rule was drafted to guarantee a person a right to particular documents, not to limit their discovery to just those documents.
Okay, so you don't want to be restricted.
We don't want to be restricted.
So my next question is, you're looking for a discovery rule that is greater than that which is provided to even criminal defendants. Am I right about that?
We're looking for a different discovery rule. We want the same rules that apply to every other civil litigant
to apply to us.
I
understand. And you're familiar with Rule 313.3, correct?
I am.
And interrogatories aren't permitted, and typically depositions are not permitted. And admissions aren't permitted.
But as Your Honor...
Am I correct or am I mistaken?
You are correct, but as Your Honor also knows, SVP actions are civil actions.
I understand.
Which are governed by Part 4 of the
I understand rules. That. So I just want to make certain I'm understanding what you want. You want to be able to... Interrogatories, depositions, admissions, the whole panoply of civil procedure.
Correct.
And do you think that that's available to those who are civilly committed, involuntarily, not SVPA?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm aware of cases where depositions have been allowed for those individuals facing psychiatric commitment.
But
office handles those cases as well.
Okay. But is it your position that the full panoply of civil discovery rights apply to those who are involuntarily civilly committed, not SVPA?
Yes, Your Honor.
So let me keep speaking civil. For example, in an automobile accident case where you have someone with a herniated disc and the defense doctor testifies that there's no herniated disc, would you be entitled to every report that doctor had provided in other cases where there was a verdict in favor of the plaintiff? Do you think that would be viable cross-examination, that you'd be allowed to use that?
It's our position, yes, it would be relevant.
In what civil case can you point to me where that's been done, where some doctor brought in and he says, you know, you testified there was no herniation, the jury gave the plaintiff $1 million, so that means you're not credible?
I don't do personal injury litigation.
Well, I can tell you it doesn't happen.
Those cases.
I was the presiding judge of civil for a long time.
Okay.
I tried a lot of cases. It doesn't happen.
Here you're facing a dire loss of liberty. And he needs discovery to be able
but
to
you're the one that's analogizing to a civil
whether the
case.
State's making, I'm sorry?
You're analogizing to the civil discovery.
Yes.
And what I'm saying to you is that this discovery you seek under number 8, for example, would not be admissible in a civil case.
When you look at the court rules themselves, looking at Court Rule 410.1, it says, except as otherwise provided, parties may obtain discovery by interrogatories, depositions, document requests for admission. Rule 410.2 authorizes all relevant and non-privileged discovery unless otherwise limited. The SVPA itself is silent on discovery, and this silence means that PD is entitled to the same...
You're overlooking the word relevant. You're overlooking the word on 4:10-2, relevant.
Obviously, relevancy is a consideration, because as you know...
in civil cases, judges are constantly paring back requests for discovery. I mean, this is not... Am I to interpret your argument that you view the civil discovery to be essentially anything that's requested is granted?
No, obviously.
The expert discovery you're seeking here is actually seeking information about other cases in which that expert is involved, which is a very, very big stretch even in the most complex civil case.
Because it goes to this particular expert's error rates.
Well, you could make that argument in any case. You could say this expert has said he or she has testified 200 times, and I want to see those files. You could maybe get something out of that, but that's not expert discovery that's given in civil cases, notwithstanding the broad language of the rule.
on a case-by-case basis, relevancy and overly burdensome nature or duplicative or cumulative, these are always concerns in any litigation. And so we would be restricted to what is reasonable. We only could seek relevant discovery that is not overly burdensome. But it's significant that the trial court in this case did not make relevancy determinations and never found that PD's discovery request was overly burdensome. In fact, to the contrary, the trial court acknowledged that some of the interrogatories was asking for information that the state could easily answer within a short time frame, but he did not even say that PD had a right to that limited information because he made a categorical ruling that there was no right to discover.
He did that based upon his 20 years of experience of never saying discovery in such cases. Yes, that's what he said.
Well, the fact that there's no published New Jersey court precedent is not a principled reason to deny
PD's discovery. I'm not disagreeing with that proposition. So you're obvious, you have, how often is the type of discovery that you are requesting that we permit presently a practice in our trial courts?
Well, right now we have a commitment court that has restricted discovery. That's what we're challenging.
Yeah, look, there are at least 460 plus people who are committed under the SVPA. And there have been hundreds more who have been through the system, and there have been hearings. Okay. In how many of those hearings, if you know, have the full panoply of civil discovery been permitted?
I'm not aware of any case, but okay. I do know that there have been discovery requests made and denied. And that's why we're seeking a clarification from this court that we do have discovery rights. Because a liberty interest is at stake, that triggers a due process protection.
So
our courts have recognized that.
So what's the nature of, okay, so let's say it does trigger it. Then we have to determine, okay, what is the scope of discovery that is consonant with due process? In criminal cases, we have far limited discovery compared to civil. And as far as I know, our discovery rule has complied with due process.
Now, in State v. Bellamy, they recognized that civil commitment is even more onerous than criminal confinement because it's indefinite and without end. We don't know whether my client will ever get released once he is committed.
Life imprisonment is pretty long.
That is true. Life imprisonment is pretty long.
Okay.
But most people who are criminally convicted do have a definite release date. That is not true for people facing SVPA confinement.
In your experience, have there been instances where people subjected to these hearings have received, as your client did here, expert reports, the medical and psychiatric reports from the STU, and the knowledge of the administrators or experts who will be called to testify?
The state routinely gives us access to our clients' own medical records and the expert reports that they plan to use. And so, they sometimes give us notice very late in the game, but we do get notice at least a day in advance who their expert will be.
So as a practical matter, that is routine discovery that's being provided right now.
They voluntarily give us access to our clients' own medical records and the expert reports that they will be using. But there's information relating to those expert reports which we're not able to get, which some of these interrogatories tried to get explanations from the experts. What are the basis for you reaching the conclusions? That's not always contained in their expert reports. What were the publications
relied
on?
Let me ask you about that, because if an expert report that does not have the basis for conclusions is a net opinion.
We've made that argument, right.
Are you saying that the expert reports, and I don't think there's anything in this record as to what the expert reports look like, are you saying they just simply say, I'm an expert and this person should be civilly committed?
What they often will do is they'll cite what they call dynamic risk factors. They just list them and then say, based on that, we find and that you meet the standard why that would be the case.
In other cases, when at least I've had the opportunity to read these expert reports, they look like expert reports that you would see in civil cases, other types of civil cases. They set forth the qualifications of the expert, and they set forth the methodology of the expert and the basis for the expert reports.
That's unfortunately missing from many of the state experts. I have made many net opinion arguments because the expert reports are conclusory in nature after citing the listing the factors without explaining the empirical basis for their decisions. So that is not an issue in this case, but it is very much an issue in many other cases that I've handled.
But it seems that some of your interrogatories, especially the early ones, were really, starting with three, are really largely duplicative of what you would expect to see in a properly constructed expert report.
And the reason why it was requested was because the expert report at issue did not contain this information. This was information that the trial court deemed was necessary for him to effectively represent PD's interest at the commitment hearing.
If the court were to extend the rule that we've talked about, 474-7D, and make clear that reports needed to be fulsome, not conclusory, would there be due process concerns in your judgment?
There would be less due process concerns, but what we're trying to do is challenge the very risk assessment methodology that the state experts are using. And in order to do that, it's not enough to just get the treatment records and the expert reports. Experts routinely say they don't cite any publications in their reports, and it's their practice not to do so. And so there's gaps that we need. Okay, I don't believe there's a principled reason to deny PD discovery that he needs to be able to meaningfully challenge whether the state has met its burden of proof, so he can effectively challenge his confinement.
Okay, so let me ask you this, pivoting off the Chief Justice's question, because Chief Justice asked you whether or not the discovery provision in the typical involuntary civil commitment would meet due process, and you said, well, that's better. So my question to you is, tell us what would be the minimal requirements of discovery that would meet due process, the minimal. Okay, not your reach, the minimal. Go ahead.
I don't see a principled reason why to deny a category of a discovery method.
I understand your argument that you think that the civil discovery rules should apply.
Yes.
Logically.
Right.
I have that. But my question to you is, what would be the minimal requirements under due process?
I believe that the state needs to show an empirical basis to support their experts' reasons why someone met the standards for commitment, not just to do a conclusory summation, but to actually show what the publications they were relying on, what research supported them, whether their risk assessment method had an effective error rate, whether they're using a risk assessment method that other practitioners in the field have used and has been proven accurate and reliable. If you look at the In Re Accutane litigation standards, they're looking at what is necessary for expert testimony to be deemed sufficient. Those questions that are being asked in Accutane, I think, are very much relevant. And if we could have discovery that will show that an expert is using a reliable methodology that has been published and peer-reviewed and is shown to have accurate risk assessment error rates. Another consideration is whether different experts use the same test and reach the same results, because sometimes there's an inter-rater reliability problem in these risk assessments.
We're talking about two different things, are we not? I mean, Accutane is a Rule 702 analysis. It's talking about the admissibility of the expert's testimony, right?
Yes, it is true.
So obviously, 702 is the benchmark under which a court decides is an expert's testimony sufficiently reliable, so we're going to let it in. So that's a different inquiry that's not before the court. What we have before the court is a discovery issue.
Right.
So in terms of this, the discovery that is always or sometimes to be allowed, according to your position, simply saying that we need enough to challenge under Accutane is not going to answer the question as to discovery.
But it's relevant in this case because this discovery was not only designed to help my client determine how he's going to successfully challenge his commitment, but also for the trial counsel to determine whether he needs to ask for a pretrial 104 hearing to challenge the adequacy of the state's risk assessment methodology. And because these interrogatories were drafted with that in mind, there's that connection. It's not simply going ahead to the commitment hearing, but also do we need a pretrial hearing that takes a step back and says, are the state's risk assessment approaches even reliable to the point that it should justify someone's potentially lifelong confinement?
Haven't a number of the risk assessment tools already been subjected to a challenge right after Doe v. Ports? I recall Justice Garibaldi writing an opinion that dealt with some of the risk assessment tools that were being used back when tiering first was coming into play. And a lot of the same tools are the ones that are being used in the sex offender units.
Well, I know I'm involved in another case where I'm representing a person who only sexually offended as a juvenile, but the state inappropriately used adult tools which have not been deemed relevant or valid with respect to those who only offend as juveniles. There have been some tests that have been deemed reliable in some limited circumstances, but we don't believe that the state is accurately using those tests. They'll take a result, and if the result shows a low recidivism risk, they'll ignore that result and say, well, there's all these other dynamic risk factors which jumps them higher. So they only will cite the results but not rely on them, and instead will rely on clinical judgment to a very large extent. We think that's a serious problem, that the experts that the state are using are really heavily relying on their own clinical judgment, not on empirically based risk assessment approaches. So we would like to challenge that even in the PD case, and some of the discovery that we requested
do you
is
have
necessary
an expert,
for us to do that.
Do you have an expert that supports that proposition that it will testify at a hearing on your behalf, not
yes,
just your
yes.
argument as counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
You have an expert?
Yes, we do.
Have you identified that expert to the state?
We were looking for the answers to the discovery so we can make sure we have the right expert. I know that the trial counsel has approached an expert, and I don't know that he's solidified whether that's the expert he will be using, but these discovery requests were deemed essential for him to be able to work with that expert to prove that the state did not meet its burden of proof and to challenge effectively whether PD should be confined in this case.
Is there anything under the SVPA that precludes the state's experts from relying on clinical judgment?
The SVPA does not directly address clinical judgment. There's actually been no published court decision that has said clinical judgment alone is sufficient. There was an appellate division decision that said clinical judgment together with actuarial tools can be appropriate, but all the experts in that case, the RS case, said clinical judgment alone is not appropriate and it does not give reliable or accurate results. That those people, even those who have great expertise in the field, will overstate a person's sexual recidivism risk when they're relying on clinical judgment.
Was that case set in the context of somebody who had been institutionalized already or somebody who was being committed for the first time?
I'd have to double check to see which category that person fell into.
Do you dispute that if your interrogatories were evaluated by an SVPA judge, it would be within the discretion of that judge to deny aspects of your interrogatories as overburdensome, as potentially infringing on privacy considerations, as beyond the scope of relevancy?
On a case-by-case basis, a trial court always has the authority to limit discovery if he finds that discovery is overly burdensome or cumulative or duplicative. Of course, the standard is not only is it relevant, but could it lead to the admission of relevant admissible evidence?
Discovery of
relevant. Yes, and so, yes, of course,
right.
a trial
right.
court
but,
retains that.
But you're not asking for this court to evaluate your interrogatories and say these are essentially acting as the trial court would be doing in an individual case. In this particular case, these interrogatories are valid and should be answered. That's not what you're asking for here.
No, I'm asking that this court reverse the trial court's holding that discovery rights don't exist when it comes to SVPA cases. He did not find any legal right to discovery. He only said that the state was fine to continue its practice of voluntarily giving access to medical records and its own expert reports. He specifically declined to find that rule 4101 applied. And we felt that that categorical exclusion of discovery violated my client's right to due process protections that he needs to protect his liberty interest.
I'm looking at your interrogatory number 6. You want to ask the expert witness, the source of the risk assessment method, whether it's been tested, and so on. If that witness testifies, and I suppose he would, you could ask all of those questions, correct? All the questions that you have in the interrogatory, you'd be able to ask of the witness. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor, you are correct, but I've been involved, I've read trial transcripts.
My next question is going to be this. I guess your point is if you could ask those questions with the witness on the stand, your position is, why can't I have that information beforehand so I can give it to my own expert? Is that
correct? And okay. To prepare, but I think we could get a fuller answer in interrogatories perhaps than when a witness is standing on the stand and gives a very short answer. I've read trial transcripts where the state expert says, I'm not aware of any publication or not to my recollection, and then goes
expert, on. Inquiry of an expert as opposed to a party. You know, when you ask a party, who is your expert, what's the basis of your expert's opinion, and so forth. But generally, questions directed toward the expert are not asked by interrogatories. See what I mean? Generally, in civil litigation with experts, you address questions as to the technicalities of the expert's opinion to the expert in questioning, because it's the party that's answering the interrogatory, not the expert.
See
what I'm talking about?
I understand.
So I would respectfully suggest that the saying, serving a party with an interrogatory that says, identify your studies and where they are. Are they peer reviewed and da 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 da? That's to the expert. You can subpoena an expert,
right?
And ask for documents. But generally, interrogatories which are directed toward a party are not the right mechanism of getting discovery as to the nuts and bolts of an expert opinion.
But we have also been denied deposition rights in other cases. In fact, I know that the trial court in this case, his first step was interrogatories. He wanted to use this to determine who would he need to depose, but that's also been a right that we have not had in the SVPA context. And if you look at question number five, that's
asking... Can I ask a question for you, five? Isn't number three, are number three and number six duplicative? If you get to, if you entitled to 3D, summarize the substance of conclusions as to each expert is expected to testify on the basis of each such conclusion and opinions. Isn't that basically a repeat of number six?
I see them as different because number three is asking for a basis of their conclusions, and number six is talking more focused about their risk assessment procedures and methods.
Wouldn't the basis of his conclusions be based on the procedures that he relied upon, the procedures that he used, and that would be the basis of his conclusion?
It could be, but it doesn't necessarily
Can you think of anything else that it could be besides that?
It could be, but again...
No, could you tell me what else it could be that wouldn't be found in number three? Because I can't think of anything else. If the expert tells you the basis for his conclusion, it's called Buckley versus Grossbard. No net opinions. It's a civil case. And if the expert doesn't give you the basis for his opinions, which you have in number three, then it's a net opinion. That's what six is trying to determine. So isn't it duplicative?
I don't see it as duplicative, but again... A trial court would always retain the right to narrow discovery if they deemed a discovery was duplicative or cumulative or unnecessary burdensome. None of those things were found in this case. The trial court expressly said he was not dealing with the relevancy of any particular interrogatory, but was making a categorical ruling, and it's to challenge that categorical ruling that were before the court today.
Counsel, could you please sum up your argument?
Well, in sum, we respectfully ask that this court apply the right to discovery to those who face SVPA confinement. Such a holding would be consistent with the plain language and purpose of the court rules, as well as consistent with New Jersey case law that protects due process rights whenever a liberty interest is at stake. And a holding that PD has a right to discovery would also be consistent with every court decision in this country that has addressed this issue and has granted broad discovery rights to SVPA litigants.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Thompson.
May it please the court. I want to pull back just a little bit to talk about two specific issues. First of all, whether the grant of civil discovery to an SVPA litigant would add value to the procedural safeguards that are already enshrined in the SVPA, and also whether the provision of civil discovery would in any way impede the state's interest in involuntarily committing an SVPA litigant. So the SVPA clearly has structures to protect and to safeguard the defendants. We know that they get the hearing, there is an amount of time, a 20-day period, a short period to proceed with that hearing, and the defendant is also entitled to counsel, but more importantly for our purposes here, they are allowed to cross-examine and to present evidence. So currently where we stand, it is up to the state to just decide whether or not they're going to provide discovery. There's nothing specific there to guide it. There's no oversight. It's basically at the largesse of the state to give information over to the defense. And what is turned over is quite partial. We know that it's reports, we know that it's notes, and we also know that there are these treatment records, but that is a tiny sliver of the information that is possibly accessible to the defendant. What we are saying now is that there has to be a larger universe so that the defendant is able to adequately try the proofs that the state is bringing. And I want to raise a little bit about the trial court's decision that was mentioned earlier. The judge in that case did say that he had overseen 20 SVPA cases. But what's really interesting about that is he said that although he observed no inability on the part of the defense counsel to conduct effective cross-examination of the state witnesses because they pointed out inconsistencies and errors in background materials and reports, he then went on to give an example of a psychiatrist testifying wherein the psychiatrist said, oh, you know, these mental abnormalities were brought on by the SVP litigant's military service. And on cross-examination, it was brought out that that individual had never served in the military. Now, that's a pretty huge inconsistency. That's a huge error. And if the defense counsel saw that, just on that tiny sliver of information that was provided, the question is, what is sitting outside of that sliver? If these interrogatories are able to provide a little bit more information, then what we can find out is what lies beneath. And given the stakes here, given the fact that the liberty interest is so, so important, it makes sense to create this burden for the state so that the danger, any danger that this litigant could impose would have to overcome that burden.
You flagged the time periods.
Yes.
They're extraordinarily short.
Yes.
They're statutory. This is not a matter of court rule, okay? Mm-hmm. How do interrogatories get served, and interrogatories of the detail that's involved here, if that were permitted by the trial court, ever get done within those time frames?
I think the key is that we have to recognize that there is a waiver involved, and that any litigant who is asking for this discovery does so knowing that all of these time crunches are going to be waived so the process can move forward. PD, for instance, has been incarcerated for over a year waiting for this litigation to play out. And so part of the conversation here is that there is going to be no impediment with regard to putting additional time burdens on the state to produce this information, because part of the trade is, hey, I want this discovery, but I'm willing to wait for it, and while I'm waiting for it, I will remain committed.
And I don't have the statute in front of me. Does the statute allow for the expansion of those time frames at the discretion of the SVPA?
I don't know that I would call it an expansion. I do think that the parties can agree to say we can push off the date of this hearing until the discovery is produced.
And if the parties don't agree, the court has that authority?
Absolutely, and I think that goes back to the traditional remedies for discovery disputes. It can go to the court, and it can be battled out in the courts as all discovery disputes are battled out.
So our court has rulemaking authority. So what rule of discovery do you argue should be applicable here that would permit the potential committee to receive the information necessary to challenge the commitment? and also consistent with the need for efficiency and, in some instances, privacy.
What would my proposed rules be?
Yes.
I think that what we first of all have to start out is what proofs have to be contested, right? So the litigant has to show that they are not a danger. So information that can be received from the state that go directly to that question, and that goes to methodology, that does, which Ms. Silver mentioned before, that goes to how the experts are forming their opinion, as well as basic questions about their accuracy, and I do think that that is important. I think that we do need to
find... So you're looking for the underlying methodology that the experts are using to form their opinions, and you want information about that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that, that's key to how this procedure goes forward. These are the central witnesses who are providing substance for the state to say that this liberty interest can be removed. That has to be tried. That has to be tested.
I understand the request to ask for the methodology that was used. Do you contemplate repeated challenges and testing of the accuracy of that methodology?
I think this is a slightly tricky question. I say that coming to this work from a lens of wrongful convictions. And so we know, as time goes on, methodologies change, assessments change. And say there was a fatal flaw found in some of the methodologies that were being used by a particular expert. If that comes up in months and in years after a particular commitment, I do believe that that should be brought out.
So take the opposite example, where you have hypothetically a fulsome hearing and a challenge to the methodology and a substantial series of convincing findings. Can the next case request that same proceeding?
Well, built into the proceedings is that there is an annual review. So if the individual is still committed, that could be raised in that annual review. And I do believe that the litigant can also request an additional hearing. And so I think that within the general and already mandated process, these things can be raised.
But, and maybe I'm not being clear enough, the methodology is what would extend beyond the individual case. It's the broader risk assessment analysis that you're asking for that be tested. Do you envision repeated tests of that same methodology for accuracy in front of judge after judge during the course of a year, during the course of 2 years?
No, but I do believe that that is within the power of the court to reject. I think that there's a point where the court can say, this has been heard, this has been decided, and there is an issue of finality. At some point, there is an issue of finality.
What about the next judge in the next courtroom on a different matter a month later?
But then there would have been a decision and some sort of basis and foundation that can then be raised and brought to the attention of the next judge who is considering the same issue.
Or an appellate court just to resolve the issue if there were disputes.
I'm sorry, I don't.
Or an appellate court would resolve the ultimate decision. So this would be lingering in the trial courts, going from one court to another.
I think that that is the normal process for any discovery dispute, and that would be applicable here as well.
But that's not a discovery dispute. We're talking about a Rule 702 challenge to the methodology now.
Sorry, yes. Yeah. So, but then we are getting a little bit far afield from the standard questions of discovery, and I realize that these also would percolate up from what we're talking about today. But it would follow, the standard discovery route. Briefly, I just want to address the question of impeding the government's interest. As I mentioned before, the government's interest isn't to involuntarily commit the SVPA litigant. So during the course of any litigation regarding this discovery, the litigant would remain committed and very literally continue the government's actual interest in the case to keep the litigant committed. I'm sorry, one moment. Oh, and lastly, I just want to speak about how the state puts together and aggregates the discovery that would be needed, and there has been statements from the state that that would gum up the works and slow down the wheels if they were expected to take on this additional burden. But as was noted earlier, that effort is to some degree already being made. The state is already producing certain reports, and the information that would be requested now would be information that could easily be obtained from their own witnesses. So aggregating that would not be entirely complicated. And to make a little bit of an analogy to the criminal context, in those contexts, in the criminal context, the state does have an obligation to provide pretrial discovery. And so the same would be applicable here. There's at least some sort of model and some sort of way to complete.
Is there a model when you look around the country and we see other states that have SVPA law equivalents and are, we're told, all providing discovery? Is there a model that we can look to for some informational purposes that's operating in another state?
As Ms. Silver pointed out in her briefing, there are 20 states and the federal government that do have very similar procedures. And
so what discovery is being provided routinely in those situations?
In open discovery, and where the exchange does happen during the course of the SVPA hearing.
But open discovery, to say open discovery is the equivalent of saying that Rule 4102 means you get what you request, and that's obviously not the case. The process in civil discovery is a very time-consuming weighing of individual requests. I mean, judges get into the weeds on these things, and obviously lawyers are encouraged to work it out together. So to say you're asking the court to provide open discovery, you're asking for something that is not available in civil litigation. There is not any kind of presumption that something that's requested is granted.
And I'm analogizing. I'm not saying that is the exact path to follow. I'm just saying that there is, we do know that there are models that exist that can be followed to produce and to gather the information.
What information exactly are they providing in those other jurisdictions? You call it open discovery, but is it reports, notes, treatment record? What in addition to those things that the state's already providing, maybe not by court rule, but by practice now?
I believe I'm going to defer some of that to Ms. Silver because we did not cover that in our brief, but I believe in addition to the reports, there are also depositions that are allowed in some of these instances as well. So it does go a little bit further than what has been provided by the state of their own accord. So, unless there are further questions, we would urge the court to adopt specific SVPA discovery rules that would allow civil discovery to be provided to all civil litigants, including those facing involuntary commitment.
Thank you. Mr. Slocum, we're at that witching hour, a little after 12:30. I know you reserved 20 minutes. Do you have a sense as to how much time you would like for your presentation?
I believe I can proceed very quickly. I think the case is rather straightforward. Not much to add. It's going to largely depend on how much the court wants to question.
Whether
you'd like me to proceed now or wait until
I appreciate that optimism. Let's give it a try.
Thank you. Good afternoon. So as stated, the court is certainly familiar with this case and the issues before it. Ultimately, the court does not need to take any action beyond affirming the specific trial court discovery order at issue. Because the trial court and the parties have applied the same automatic and robust disclosures under Rule 4:74-7 for over 20 years, the court need take no action to change the status quo. However, to the extent that the court believes this issue should be more firmly resolved, either that Rule 4:74-7 D and E should be amended to expressly apply to SVPA proceedings, or a new court rule should be promulgated to codify the current process. And to that end, I do want to clarify the current process. It is comprehensive, and it provides individuals facing commitment with automatic, robust disclosures which far surpass the traditional discovery tools. when a petition for civil commitment is filed, all documents relating to the individual's criminal history, incarceration, their treatment, if any, and the basis for the commitment are immediately provided to that individual and counsel. And I want to emphasize all documents. The state does not make a relevance judgment or withhold any document for any reason. Literally everything, the entirety of the universe of documents which the state has and has been able to procure, are provided. Nothing is hidden. As the case progresses, immediately upon completion of an expert report, that expert's report and the CV are provided to counsel, and counsel also have real-time access to the individual's treatment records and to the treatment providers and the experts. In advance of the hearing, counsel is on notice as to the doctor's diagnoses and their risk assessments and the bases for those diagnoses and risk assessments, including any tools used. I want to note first that there was a question about have any of these, well, one, that these reports are highly detailed. They do go into great detail as to the basis for everything, for the diagnoses, for the risk assessments, what tools are used, the basis for those tools. Additionally, there have been court decisions addressing these tools and addressing their admissibility, addressing their reliability. RS speaks specifically to the Static 99 actuarial tool, which is used in every single commitment proceeding, and other cases, AY, most recently published decision of the Appellate Division earlier, well, at this point last year, in 2019, it also addresses this tool as well as other tools which are used in all these hearings. Counsel have the opportunity to challenge all aspects of the state expert's reports. If counsel believes that additional time is needed, either because they now wish to seek an expert and they had not previously, they are free to seek an adjournment and to get their own expert and proceed. They are not ambushed the day of trial and told, this is the basis for the state's position, good luck. That's simply not the way the system works. In short, individuals facing commitment have every tool and every opportunity to contest their commitment. They are afforded automatic disclosures which far surpass traditional discovery tools. Appellant's arguments and the amicus arguments are fundamentally flawed as they've created a false dichotomy, asserting that foregoing certain discovery tools amounts to no discovery. That is not the state's position, that was not the trial court's ruling, and has never been anybody's position. The state fully acknowledges that individuals facing commitment have due process rights and due process interests and must be provided with everything, and so they are. As stated, the state continues to provide the automatic, robust disclosures that it has for 20 years. Additionally, the specific discovery tools at issue here, and not specifically frogs, but the actual tools, are incompatible with the statutory timeframes of the SVPA, which sets the hearing within 20 days, the reports must be completed within 5 days before the hearing. That is entirely incompatible with 60 days for ROGs times for depositions. Additionally, it's incompatible with legislative intent for expedited hearings, and ultimately, they are entirely unnecessary. Formal discovery tools are appropriate to determine the issues in the case and also the scope of the case, the scope of trial, but neither of those issues is implicated here. As stated, everything is provided. Second, the issues for these trials are very well settled. The state bears the burden to prove each of the three statutory prongs by clear and convincing evidence. The trial has a set scope with discrete issues and known topics. There is no need for further exploration through discovery tools. Ultimately, the system works, and it has worked for 20 years. The state provides everything as an automatic disclosure, and although the state believes that Rule 4:74-7(d)(e) applies and has been following that, we do acknowledge that on its face, the rule only applies to general civil commitment. However, it is not as though the state is in a Wild West situation and where we could at any time voluntarily stop these disclosures. Basic due process already demands this and protects this. There is no risk of the state withdrawing these disclosures. Employing traditional discovery tools in the SVPA context would throw this system unnecessarily into chaos.
So forget about general discovery. How about answering a question like interrogatory number 6? Would you have a problem with that?
So, Your Honor, that interrogatory is already answered by provision of expert reports and the CV. It provides all that information and then some.
You're saying that the information that you're providing states the source of the risk assessment, whether it's been tested, whether it's been peer reviewed, the error rate. You're saying you provide that already?
So the concept of error rate and those the repeated attempts for individuals trying to seek a statistical quantification for a commitment, no. But that's because, as the experts will always testify when cross-examined, as they very frequently are, is because you cannot. You cannot provide statistical quantification for individuals. Not only is that the experts' opinions, as they repeatedly bring these cases, it's also been settled as a matter of law. And most recently, in the Appellate Division's decision in AY, citing numerous cases from this court, from the Appellate Division, and from the U.S. Supreme Court, that there is it is an impossibility.
Okay, so let me simplify my question.
Certainly.
It seems to me that from what I'm hearing is that the state has no problem with providing the committee with the underlying methodology of the risk assessment tool. Am I correctly summarizing what I think you've been representing to us?
Very nearly, Your Honor. The only distinction I would draw, it's not that the state, I'm not saying we have no problem providing it. I'm saying that we already provide it. It is already provided in the normal course.
Okay, so if you already provide it, then you're representing to us, if in some cases you don't, you will.
Certainly, Your Honor. I mean, yes. And to the extent if the defense ever has concern or believes that the report does not act adequately set forth the methodology, they have full opportunity to cross-examine. They have full opportunity to bring their own expert to further.
No, I mean, provide it in advance, so they're not hearing it for the first time when the expert is on the stand. They don't want to start asking the expert on the stand the underlying methodology. They want you to provide that with them in advance so they can decide whether or not to get their own expert.
Is that being provided in the expert report today?
So, Your Honor, yes. My understanding is that yes. I mean, the reports are very detailed. The reports do not simply list dynamic risk factors. They identify dynamic risk factors play a role in the individual's likelihood to reoffend. These are specific risk factors this individual exhibits. These are why these specific risk factors for this individual show that he is highly likely to reoffend. The reports do go into that level of detail. In the event there were a report which did not, I would like to say that I would like to think that the state, that the deputies who handle these trials would catch that and flag it. However, the reports are provided simultaneously to both those deputies and to the public defender. So there's no opportunity for us to vet them or say we think this is needed more to be added. However, if in advance were an expert report flagged by the public defender or by our office as incomplete, certainly we would want to address that. There'd be no interest.
Is there daylight between the items you just described and what's in six? Identification of the risk assessment procedures that were used.
The extent to which there may be, Your Honor, would be the details as to. Sorry, if I can grab the actual language in front of me. So specifically with interrogatory number six, which is at AA22. So the source of the risk assessment methodology is in the expert reports. They identify that these are the methodologies used by experts in the field and always employed by them. The risk assessment has been tested as to whether the reports typically answer that specific question and use the language. This methodology has been tested, probably not, but in the same way that A is answered as saying, these are the methodologies typically used by myself and by individuals in my field. It is answered through that.
I'm sorry, please, go ahead.
Can you tell us how many different methodologies there are approximately and how many have been addressed in precedential opinions?
Certainly, Your Honor. So ultimately, the final decision, it is typically a mix between clinical judgment and actuarial tools. However, as a matter of law, the courts have held that clinical judgment alone is sufficient, that the actuarial tools are not required, and that the court is free to reject them wholesale. That is in the RS decision and repeated again in the AY decision. The other tools which are typically used, the most often would be the static 99R actuarial tool, which has been addressed frankly, ad nauseum in decisions, and has most certainly been upheld repeatedly. Other common tools, these stable 2007 is used frequently. I'm conscious that it has certainly been discussed in appellate decisions in many briefs, which opposing counsel and I have been on, and has been upheld. I do not have a particular case in front of me or publication, most likely in unpublished appellate division decisions. Other frequent tools, there is the PCLR, the psychopathy checklist revised, is used in very frequently in these cases. It also has been affirmed many, many times, though primarily in unpublished decisions. I'm not conscious of any published cases which do speak to it. The MNOST, I believe MNOST, is also frequently used, but it's not used as frequently as any of the other ones. I believe that the MNOST is addressed in AY and is accepted in the AY decision.
I assume that you would oppose the discovery that's in 7, 8, and 9 that talks about other individuals and the outcomes of their cases.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. What is the principled line that you draw between what, in essence, in response to the Chief's question, Justice Albin's questions on 6, which are really about the methodologies of the expert, explaining the methodologies of the expert, and 7, 8, and 9, which talk about coded production of assessments of others?
Yeah. So there are a number of points I would like to respond to there, Your Honor. First is that initially the state would object and oppose to any of these formal discovery tools as they are unnecessary and incompatible with the statutory timeframes. So no matter what is being asked, if it's being done through an interrogatory, we believe that's inappropriate and should not be done. Specifically here, the difference between interrogatory 6 versus 7, 8, 9 on its face, or on their face, 7, 8, 9 do specify every other resident and any other experts that testify for them, and is in no way limited to the experts in PD's case, so there is a very blatant facial lack of relevancy or interest. To the extent, if 7, 8, 9 were pared down to only the experts testifying in PD's case, and the error rate, as the PD phrases it, versus interrogator 6 for the experts in PD's case, there remain differences there.
So this would be a huge burden, among other things.
Yes, absolutely, the state believes so, Your Honor. And not only would it be, and that is something I would like to address particularly because, or as the amicus.
It would be irrelevant, wouldn't it? Also, yes. Besides a burden, what happened in another case
is facially irrelevant, Your Honor, yes.
Completely irrelevant to either the assessor's valid or not, and the expert made a mistake in that case, or it's not. They're seeking to test the validity of the method. And whether there was some error in some other case, and doesn't mean there's an error in this case if the test itself is valid.
Absolutely.
So it would be irrelevant for purposes of any type of proof.
Absolutely, Your Honor. These cases, SVPA commitment cases, are very fact-specific. They are very individualized to this person's diagnoses, this person's criminal history, this person's treatment affect, looking at experts, other experts, or even this expert's decisions with regard to other people 10 years ago, is so facially irrelevant. I do want to address the state's interest as amicus raised. The amicus asserted both that discovery would add value and that providing discovery would not impede the state's interest. As expressed repeatedly, it most certainly does not provide value as everything is already provided. These types of discovery and the traditional discovery tools are just unnecessary in the SVPA context. Secondly, with regard to the state's interest is not keeping this person civilly committed for the rest of his life. That is not what the state wants. The state interest, as expressed in the statute, is for the control, care, and treatment of these individuals for the protection of society. The first point is, yes, is the control. It is to confine them to the secure facility, but for their treatment. It is so this for an individual like PD, who has now been at the facility but for more than 2 years has refused all treatment because this hearing is pending and he doesn't want to discuss it before the hearing, that impedes the state's interest in providing him that treatment, making him better so that he is not a threat to society. The state most certainly does not want to keep him there for the next 40 years or until the end of his life. We want to treat him so that he may re-enter society. That is the state interest. The state interest is not keeping him confined indefinitely. The point was raised that, or the argument was raised that, the argument was asserted that the state provides less discovery in these cases than in a typical fender bender, which is just not the case. And I apologize for being so repetitive on it, but I do want to say again, the automatic, robust disclosures provided here are everything. And it's very significant to look at the comparison, not to compare civil commitment under the SCPA to a fender bender, but to compare it to a criminal proceeding. And as the court noted, in a criminal trial, there are no interrogatories. However, just like in a criminal trial, there are these automatic disclosures by the state, and the state is required to provide any exculpatory evidence. So does the state here in these proceedings. Just as due process is met in criminal proceedings, just as due process is met in general civil commitment proceedings, due process is met here in the SCPA proceedings with the automatic and robust disclosures which the state makes. Unless the court has any questions.
I just have one more, if I may. You talked about objecting to interrogatories. If we are talking about expert disclosures, and by that I mean expert disclosures that include a sufficient explanation of the methodology being used so that that methodology can be understood, evaluated, and potentially challenged in a Rule 702 hearing if the committee decides to go in that direction. Isn't that best accomplished by specific requirements as to what needs to be in the expert's report? Do you see what I'm saying? You're saying no interrogatory should be off limits, but it seems to me that even, you know, and heard your very thorough explanation as to what's disclosed, individual expert reports may or may not make that benchmark of providing sufficient information about the methodology. So why not establish certain requirements for SVPA expert reports that ensure that the disclosures, the expert report provides the information necessary for the committee to understand it, cross-examine, and potentially challenge the methodology without going in the direction of interrogatories. See what I mean?
I believe I do, Your Honor, yes. And if I could have one moment just to think about it.
Sure.
So yes, initially, it is my understanding, it would be the state's position, that the expert reports are sufficiently thorough as they are. However, to the extent the court believes, or the court finds, that it would be appropriate to specify in a rule through an amendment or an adoption of necessary components of the report, that it may be beneficial. However, I would note that there isn't necessarily a need for that, because as it is the state's burden at trial, in the event an expert report were incomplete or could be deemed a net opinion, that is to the individual's benefit at trial to then have the report deemed inadmissible and remove the expert, and that expert's testimony would be inadmissible.
What should the rule say, whether or not you're currently turning it over? What would be a thoughtful approach? What categories of information should it encompass?
Sorry, for a new rule adoption, new promulgation. The state's proposal is that the court would promulgate a new rule adopting the current procedure. For some inartful wording toward that effect at this point, that the state would provide all documentation in its possession relating to the individual, period, hard stop, because the state makes no limitation.
Let's approach it slightly differently. Sure. What categories of information should the rule call for?
All criminal records, all confinement records, any treatment records, any expert reports created in the course of the commitment proceedings.
So if I understood Justice Patterson's question, it was what should the expert report, what categories of information should be included there?
Sorry, specifically the expert report. So yes, CVs, but specifically in the expert report. As the experts do now, and which the state believes is what is necessary, identify the individual, identify the sources of information relied upon, identify the criminal history or the background information relied upon, set forth the expert's understanding of the offending history, a discussion of the diagnoses and the bases for those diagnoses, a discussion of the any risk assessment tools used, again, which is most often the Stat 99R, and then a comprehensive risk assessment, which discusses the dynamic static risk factors, dynamic risk factors, and how they apply to the individual to demonstrate his or her likelihood to reoffend.
And in that report, the risk assessment tools, what is it that provides a basis for someone, whether the judge or the committee, counsel, another expert, to understand the methodology and the reliability of the methodology of that tool? Shouldn't the report discuss and establish by expert testimony the reliability of the tool that's being used to make the assessment, consistent with what Rule 702 requires?
In the report itself, Your Honor, I do not believe that would be necessary, particularly in this setting where it's a rather narrow subset of tools. These are specific tools used in every case with which all the experts are familiar, with which all of the attorneys are familiar, with which these specialist judges are familiar.
Why shouldn't that be in reports? That's something that's in expert reports, at least since Daubert in the federal courts, and going back decades, the methodology and the reliability of the methodology is talked about in reports. I know it would add pages.
To that end, I have no reason to contest or argue against what would effectively be boilerplate in the reports, but the inclusion of boilerplate may help simplify or clarify the process for everyone involved.
Well, whether it's boilerplate or it's not boilerplate,
it wouldn't be problematic.
If the expert and includes the type of testing he or she did so that it's available, they don't have to. I haven't seen where they include whether it's reliable or not. That's up to the trial court to decide whether it's reliable or not. If they're on a hearing, Swann's hearing or some other type of hearing, experts shouldn't have to say, I think this is reliable and here's why. I've never seen that in a report.
In that exact language, Your Honor, neither have I. And that's, again, why I note that here is the same experts who are very familiar with the field, the same specialist judges familiar with the field who are involved in all these cases.
Anything, any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Oh, yes, a moment.
I just have to rebut the state's contention that case law has said that clinical judgment alone is sufficient. No case has made that decision. In the RS case, it was simply looking at whether the static 99 actuarial was admissible. In AY, they found that the actuarial tool showed a 70% sexual recidivism risk. All of those cases said clinical judgment is unreliable and not accurate and cannot alone be the basis for a commitment decision. And the expert reports are not as robust and thorough as the state contends. In fact, they'll just list the tests that were applied. Sometimes they may show a recidivism risk as low as 2% or 11%. They conclude someone is highly likely to sexually reoffend without explaining the process of how they got there, without explaining how they weighed various dynamic risk factors. We wanted to understand what their thought process is so that we can challenge the decisions that the state experts are making and effectively challenge a person's commitment. PD would like that right. We object to the state categorically saying that discovery will always be overly burdensome. It needs to be done on a case-by-case basis. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to counsel for the very fine presentation. We will take a half-hour break.